Okay, so relic soils, as I'm sure most of you know, are surface soils that have gone through environmental changes. And while the record in these soils can be very complicated at times, there are opportunities, I think, in certain environments to derive some very interesting climatic information from them. So today what I'll do is talk about an interesting relic, ancient relic soil we encountered at the periphery of the Atacama Desert in Chile. And I'll try to walk you through some of the things we've interpreted about what it tells us about climate change over the last, say, 2 to 4 million years in this region. So the motivation for the project is in northern Chile, Peru, and Argentina, there's teams of people in the geosciences interested in the history of the rise of the Andes. The Andes are the second highest mountain range in the world. And there's a lot of debate about the pace and rate at which the Andes have been uplifted. And people have used a lot of different approaches to address this, geomorphic, geochemical. Some people have used paleosols to try to argue about the information about the uplift of the Andes. But I would say everything has its drawbacks and there's weaknesses. And so there's an opportunity for different approaches to learn more about the environmental history. And this is where ancient soils in the Atacama Desert, which lies just to the west of the Andes, offers an opportunity to learn more about environmental history. One simple hypothesis would be as the Andes are uplifted, they start to block the easterly flow from the Amazon basin and could cause an increase in aridity and changes in soil formation conditions. So ideally, if in a relic soil to look at an ancient complex soil that has climate information, it's ideally it would be best to look at a soil that's gone from a wetter phase to a drier phase. That would mean the minerals, chemical components formed in the wetter environment would be more persistent and resistant to the changes that occur in a drier condition. So ideally, and this is what we encountered in Chile, you go from a clay-forming environment drying to a carbonate accumulation environment, ultimately to a soluble salt like sulfates and chlorides, would be a great way to preserve the components from the previous soil formation phase and provide information about the past climatic conditions. So the research site, this map from Google Earth doesn't provide you with much information, but basically to the north is the end of the absolute desert, which has no plants or animals, or very few anyway. And then a few hundred kilometers to the south, the climate changes to one similar to what we have here in San Diego, a Mediterranean coastal climate regime. So the site sits right at the border between the modern desert and the Mediterranean climate to the south. It's very dry. The mean annual precipitation is about 22 millimeters per year, relatively mild, 15 degrees mean annual temperature. And the other thing about this region, about this desert that differs from North America, is that most of the basin deposits are either Miocene or Pliocene in age. The quaternary mark on the landscape is very small. That's also an indicator that climate has shifted somewhat during the Cenozoic into the quaternary, in that the streams and rivers have done very little to modify these ancient alluvial deposits. This is a Google cross look to the west. This is a stream coming out of the Andes. The stream has cut into what's mapped as a Mio-Pliocene alluvial fan. It's correlated to some ash deposits that are found in the region about 50 kilometers to the north and the south. This stream channel is about a kilometer and a half wide. And this sort of represents, in the channels and the braided material in the stream represents sort of the quaternary modification of the landscape. But this gives you a sense of how well preserved ancient landforms are. This is that Mio-Pliocene alluvial fan. Incredible preservation, beautiful desert pavement on the top. The soils have accumulated salts, they've expanded over time. Very little evidence of surficial erosion. So these are areas that once they start the soils start forming, they retain a lot of information about their environmental history. So this is the road cut that we looked at along the highway. On your left is the color, in the middle is a black and white. Basically, it is, if you classified it, it would be a petrocalcic palearctic. I think that would probably be the correct definition. It started out as a gravelly alluvial deposit. The fine-grained fraction was probably a sandy loam. Right now, it has an incredibly thick BT horizon, up to 35% clay. Some of these cobbles and clasts in the alluvium are degraded, broken, weathered. So there's plenty of evidence of chemical weathering. And then overlaying on top of that is a very thick calcic and petrocalcic horizon. And we can say that stratigraphically, the carbonate came after the clay formation phase, because there's common, beautiful, angular, blocky peds in the soil that are non-calcareous on the inside and only have carbonate on the exterior or in seams that are going into the interior. So the clay formed first, and then the carbonate has been slowly engulfing the soil profile. So these are the stages of development, and I'll sort of tell you what the story is, and then I'll give you some information to support this as we go through it. First of all, there was a clay formation phase in a relatively humid environment, accumulating up to 35% clay and some chemical weathering associated with it. There was a long period of carbonate accumulation, and from the carbonate laminations, we can say that during this entire period of carbonate formation, it was just getting steadily drier during this long extended period of carbonate accumulation. And then the present climate is drier than anything preserved in the soil. So it's gone through a very prolonged drying process since it started. With all the clay, I wanted to demonstrate that there have been some chemical weathering. So we used the tau calculations, where you find an index element to compare your soluble components to. One of the problems, and I think some of you in the audience have worked with this, with alluvial deposits, it's difficult to find an index element that isn't affected by winnowing of the material. So we focused on rare earth elements because it's been reported that they're sort of spread through all the silicate minerals in soil. And indeed, when we did plots of like this one, I plot cerium versus neodymium, they showed nice relationships suggesting that the rare earths or associated elements were probably the best behaved index elements. But anyway, for the purposes of our paper we're preparing, I did tau values with cerium and zirconium. And in terms of losses of sodium and potassium, both these index elements show losses in certain horizons of up to 75% of of sodium and 50% or 25% of the potassium. In terms of silicon, there's a slight loss, 5 to 10% of silicon. Probably most of the silicon wound up in secondary clays, but certainly this is evidence then that supports the chemical weathering that accumulated the clays in the soil. Now, I want to focus on the carbonate isotopes briefly, so I want to focus on two parts of it. One, in the first step, we just looked at the fine-grained carbonate between the cobbles, so it sort of integrates the long history of carbonate accumulation. And we looked at the carbon isotopes in the carbonates, and these are the dots here. That's the data points. And then these lines on the that they match through our model fits from a respiration model. Basically, I want to just illustrate or tell you that biological CO2 in soil is depleted in carbon-13. The atmosphere is enriched. So as this biological CO2 diffuses to the atmosphere, there's sort of a mixing curve that develops. And the more biological production you have, it moves things over to your left, or if there's less biological production, it moves this carbon isotope curve over to your right. We matched basically a curve that says there's about 150 grams of carbon produced per meter squared per year. If you want to put this in an environmental context, this would be similar to pinyon pine and juniper rangelands in the Great Basin. So this is sort of the biological situation that isotope value projects. Also, to sort of correlate to this, there was a recent paper done by Peters et al. Just across the Andes in Argentina, where they looked at Holocene and Pleistocene soils that range from 130 to 320 millimeters of rainfall per year. Basically, it had, in a broad brush perspective, similar depth profiles, substantiating this idea that when the carbonate in this soil formed, the rainfall is probably an order of magnitude or more higher than its present conditions. Now, we also looked at carbonate isotope records in the laminations at the bottoms of the gravels in the soil. So there were a few cases where we could pull out clasts that had a centimeter and a half of carbonate accumulated in a very systematic growth pattern. So we looked at it two ways. First, we did a hand drilling technique through them. And then this summer, we one of my students went to the NSF-funded secondary ionization mass spectrometry lab at the University of Wisconsin that's run by John Valley, and used laser ablation SIMS work to look more microscopically at the isotope trends along these gradients. And I just want to say that for pedologists, I think this is a really interesting and great opportunity, because here's here are three spots that Eric did last summer sort of to look at the reproducibility in a given location. And you can see that the scale is up 20 microns. So these are 10 to 5 micron scale spots that you can do, and you can run very precise transects across your samples. So for carbon isotopes along these laminations, we just have the drilled sample set. So this is the interior next to the rock. This is the exterior of the coating. What it shows is over time, there's in all the transects we did, there's a continuous increase in carbon-13 in the carbonate, and that suggests more atmospheric CO2 that's been mixed with the carbonate, and suggesting a continuous decline in respiration over the course of the growth of these carbonate laminations. So in the Mojave Desert, it would be the same on the left. The carbon isotope values are similar to, say, pinyon, pine, juniper woodlands. The ones on the right are similar to creosote bush sort of landscapes that we find in the present Mojave Desert. Now, the oxygen isotopes, these were the ones we could do both by hand drilling and with the SIMS. And so I want to just say a few things about that. At the top is the hand-drilled, are the hand-drilled values. And in general, there's a lot of noise in there, but the scale has been sort of expanded to sort of exaggerate the trends with time, but really it's sort of a homogeneous change with time. The oxygen isotopes remain relatively constant with time, which is reasonable given that most of the storms come from the Pacific. The SIMS data provide enormous complexity and patterns that we don't see with this hand-drilled method, because that homogenizes so much of the time information. So I really think there's an incredible opportunity to derive more information using microscopic techniques. The big problem with the entire project so far is geochronology. The carbonates are too old to use radiocarbon, too old to use U-series dating. We did some U-series dating, and it's older than 400,000 years. Uranium-lead dating, which is potentially possible, hasn't been perfected for pedogenic carbonates. So right now, we have very broad brush age control on this, but this is an interesting opportunity for the future for pedologists and geochemists to come up with ways to date these things. So the results are our interpretations. There's evidence of long-term extensive chemical weathering, probably pre-Pleistocene, evidence for post-weathering carbonate accumulation. The amount of carbonate in the soil divided by the deposition rate would indicate it probably took a million to a million and a half years to accumulate this carbonate. We need methods for dating to place all this information in a really tight age control. But I think in general, when you go, if you look at it in a broad scale from the clay producing component or phase to its present arid condition, it suggests that this soil has gone through a decline of maybe 50 to 100 centimeters of rainfall decline over the course of its lifespan. So that's it. I hope we have get a paper out on this next year, and thanks for listening. Yes. The laminations there accumulate at the bottom, and The ones that we use show no particular evidence that they had formed, spalled off, and then reformed. So we did transects across, I think, 3 or 4 class, and then multiple transects on a few of them, just to see if we could reproduce this in different class. And in general, I think I was pretty happy with the way it reproduced itself. Curtis, did you have a question? Well, that's a good point. No, we didn't try it, but it's a reasonable thing to do just to see, learn more about how much modern carbon might be migrating into the soil. My guess it would be low, but it's worth, I think it's really worth doing to just provide that, have that data at hand to see what's going on.